This is the evening service at Holy Trinity on the 19th of November 2000. The preacher is Paul Barker. His sermon is entitled "Go to Jail!" exclamation mark, and is from Genesis chapter 39 verses 1 to 23.
The odd spot in yesterday's age said it all. Jealous Russian boyfriends are hiring a team of professional seducers to test their beloved's fidelity before tying the knot. The husband-to-be introduces an imposter to set the trap. And then comes the sting. Most fiancés fail to resist. It's almost inevitable, isn't it? The seductress weaves her spell and charm, and even the best intentioned of men fall. Or the glamorous playboy allures, and even the noblest of women are drawn. It happened in The Great Gatsby, it even happens on The Bill, it happens in TV program after TV program, book after book, film after film. And every day in real life as well, people are seduced into having sexual adultery and affairs. Well, after all, life is lived in the face of seduction and temptation and deceit. And the attraction of illicit, immoral sexual activity is strong. We're sexual beings. It is a strong attraction for many people. But what makes Genesis 39 so striking is that Joseph didn't yield. He stayed pure, despite the temptation, despite the constant pressure. We're told that the woman, day after day, tried to tempt him to have sex with her. But he keeps his distance. Certainly, at the first level, this is a chapter that gives us a striking illustration of a person who is morally upright in the face of sexual temptation. And at least at the first level, that's the meaning that we are to understand from this text. But the consequences of his moral upright character leads to an even more intriguing moral dilemma, as we'll see. Joseph, who's the key character, the hero of this story, is not the Joseph who's the father of Jesus, but this is the Technicolor Dreamcoat variety. He's been sold into slavery by his jealous brothers. We heard the account of that last Sunday night in chapter 37. Those Ishmaelite traders took him down to Egypt from Israel or Palestine, and there they sold him into the house of a man called Potiphar. He's an Egyptian. He's a nobleman. He's the captain of the guard of Pharaoh's court. He's quite a senior civil servant, it seems. A significant person indeed. And as a slave of Potiphar, Joseph does particularly well. Indeed, everything that he turns his hand to prospers. Blessing abounds in the work of Joseph in the house of Potiphar. And it seems to be implied in these verses 2 to 4 that there are at least three stages of promotion for Joseph. We're told in verse 2 that he was in the house of his Egyptian master. And it seems to imply that maybe initially he was out in the fields, the lowest of the slaves were outside. So he's promoted to be an inside slave. More important things get done inside the house, and he's promoted because he's done so well outside in the fields, presumably. Secondly, perhaps there's a promotion indicated by the words in verse 4 that he found favour in his sight and attended him. So that not only is he working inside, a promotion, but now he's a personal attendant of this man called Potiphar. But again, there's another step perhaps implied, because the end of verse 4 tells us that Potiphar made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. He is the chief slave, the one above all the other slaves, Now, maybe there's not three distinct steps of promotion, but it does seem to imply that Joseph has done well and he's been moved into more and more senior places, so that at the end of the sequence, everything in Potiphar's house is in his hands, we're told. Potiphar had total trust in him. Verse 6 tells us that. So the man left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and with him there he had no concern for anything except for the food that he ate, which doesn't mean to imply that he's gluttonous. It's just probably because Joseph was a foreigner, he would be precluded from attending to the actual food that this man ate. Probably that's what lies behind that comment in verse 6. And Potiphar's house, as a result of all of this, is richly blessed. So verse 5, for example, tells us that from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Everything's going well. And here is a little glimpse, if you like, of one of those promises to Abraham, in fact, being fulfilled. Those who bless you, I will bless. And here is a person from another race being blessed by God, because he in turn is blessing Joseph, a descendant of Abraham to whom the promise was made in chapter 12. Apart from verse 1, the man is never mentioned by name. His name is Potiphar, but everywhere else he's the master or the husband or his master. So that throughout the story, what becomes stressed is not just that Joseph worked for Potiphar, but that he was the master and Joseph the slave. And what it highlights throughout the story is Joseph's trustworthiness, Joseph's loyalty and faithfulness to his master. So above anything else in the story, Joseph is absolutely loyal and faithful to his master. He's a faithful steward in everything in his master's house. And the way it's described too in verses 2 to 6, the verbs that are used suggest that we're not just talking about one incident of blessing and prosperity, but that this was a consistent pattern. Joseph was consistently faithful, consistently loyal, and consistently successful. And Potiphar's house was consistently blessed as a result. And one more thing about Joseph. It's almost tacked on as an afterthought at the end of verse 6. We're told at the end of verse 6 that Joseph was handsome and good-looking. Not just handsome and not just good-looking. Handsome and good-looking. And the two go together for emphasis. That is, he's drop-dead gorgeous, basically. He's an Adonis of the ancient Egyptian world. And he's just like his mother, who is the only other person in the Bible who's described in those terms, handsome and good-looking, back in chapter 29. That's Rachel, his mother. It's like Princess Di and Prince William, I guess. Each is, to different eyes, good-looking. And the girls would have drooled over Joseph like they drool over Prince William. But there's the problem. Because at least one married woman did the same. She drooled over Joseph. In fact, Mrs. Potiphar gawked and lusted after him. We're told in verse 7 that after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph. And we're meant to imagine, I think, Mrs. Potiphar sitting down, watching the slaves doing all their business around the house, and she's just watching Joseph go backwards and forwards, and her eyes are fluttering and her mouth's open, and she's drooling down there thinking, gosh, what a gorgeous slave my husband has brought into my house. And so she says to him, lie with me. What an extraordinarily blunt demand. Lie with me. Presumably she said something more. Presumably that's not the only chat-up line that she used. But it's very blunt, and we're not told that she said anything else, because what the teller of this story is trying to get us to see is just how unashamed she is in her lust for him. There's no sort of, you know, weaving sort of little innuendos here and there, like, oh, my shoulders are sore, could you massage them or something? Just lie with me. What sort of a woman is this? She's the opposite extreme from Joseph. She's a bad egg. She's devious, conniving and lying, as we're going to see shortly. She is certainly brazen in her attempts to commit adultery. And in contrast to her two Hebrew words, lie with me is three in English, but two in Hebrew, Joseph replies with 35 words. He doesn't just say no, but he actually gives a full account of himself and why he refuses. His character is in clear contrast to hers, the way the story's told. So in verse 8, Joseph refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, with me here, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He's not greater in his house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Now, what Joseph says about himself there could almost be termed bragging, but we know it's not, because it's true. Because the earlier verses have told us that it's true. Joseph is a faithful and loyal student in his master's house, and his master has given him everything in his house, in effect, to look after. Except, of course, his wife. Joseph's being honest. And the three reasons he gives for refusing to commit adultery with his master's wife, Mrs. Potiphar, are that firstly, he doesn't want to abuse his master's trust. His master's given him everything in the house to look after except his wife, and he will not cross the boundary of that trust. The second reason is he doesn't want to offend his master. He doesn't want to, you know, snub him by doing something with his wife that he shouldn't. And the third reason lies at the end of his speech, and the most significant reason of all, coming at the climactic point of his refusal. How could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You see, it's not just a sin against the master, though it is that. It is also a sin against God. And remember, this is before the days of the Ten Commandments to tell you that. Even from the beginning, adultery is a sin against God. We're meant to see here somebody of impeccable character. The description of Joseph in this chapter is of somebody who is above reproach, who is, in a sense, flawless in the way he responds to the situation he faces. He's flawless in word and deed. But Mrs. Potiphar is determined to get her man, and she won't take no for an answer. So in verse 10, we're told that although she spoke to Joseph day after day, so that clearly implies that she's not heeded his refusal, and every day she's saying to him, "Come on, lie with me," Joseph declined. Who can imagine what she did each day after the first refusal? The new perfume that she sprayed on, the new makeup, the short skirts and low-cut tops, perhaps. Who can imagine the winks as Joseph went about his business, the fluttering eyelashes, the other little comments that she might have made in the midst of "lie with me"? And Joseph, day after day, refused to yield. Day after day. And we're told at the end of verse 10, that not only would he not lie with her, that is, have sex with her, but he wouldn't even lie beside her, is the expression that's used there. It is almost suggesting that maybe she has said with him, "Look, we don't have to have sex, just lie on the bed next to me or on the couch, you know, recline next to me." No, he says, "I'm not even going to do that. I will not lie beside you, let alone lie with you in having sex." But even more than that, the end of verse 10 tells us that he would not only not lie beside her, but he would not even be with her. He's keeping his distance, and a fair distance at that. Presumably what it means is that even though he has some contact with her, he is trying never to be with her alone, keeping out of the way, keeping other servants around, keeping out of her clutches, so to speak. Too many Christians fall, sexually at least, because they think they are strong and they can take strong steps towards somebody thinking they won't go further. But they are foolish because they do not realize how weak they are. Sexual attraction is strong, and the pressures of our society to be promiscuous sexually are very strong indeed. You don't have to look at many television advertisements. You don't have to read many novels or see many films or watch many TV programs before you realize that some sort of adulterous affair or sleeping around seems to be quite acceptable. So do it. Too many Christians think they are strong enough to resist. So they can flirt or be with somebody or go with somebody or be perhaps a little bit too affectionate and think they're going to be strong enough not to go too far, but they end up falling because they're weaker than they think they are and go further than they ought. And Joseph, by refusing not only to have sex but not to lie beside her and not even to be with her, is giving us an example of how we are to deal with temptation. Not to court temptation, but in fact to flee it. Too many Christians know that you should not cross over that boundary. But instead of keeping well away from the edge, they try and live their lives leaning over the top, thinking that somehow they're safe. But they're not, because they're weaker than they think they are. Keep out of places of weakness. Keep out of places of vulnerability. If you're traveling with your work, be careful where you stay and with whom you stay and with whom you travel. Don't go if you're vulnerable to sexual activity while you're away from home. It's not worth it. Or take your spouse. Or take a colleague whom you can trust. I remember one experienced Christian minister at a clergy conference once saying, "Stay behind the desk." It's a blunt advice for a clergyman or a counsellor, but it's safest. Because too many Christian leaders or pastors or counsellors or ministers fall because they become too compassionate and too affectionate with people in need. So they come in effect, metaphorically speaking at least, if not literally, around from their desk to hug or to embrace or to comfort or to put an arm around somebody in need, and they've taken a step of vulnerability and the other person is vulnerable and they end up going where they do not intend to go but where they're drawn into, too far, over the top, over the boundary. Stay behind the desk. If you're vulnerable when you're particularly tired, be especially careful. If you're vulnerable after a couple of drinks, don't drink. Know that you're weak, not strong. And don't think you're so strong that you can go where you ought not to go. Joseph went nowhere near her. He kept his distance from temptation. And it is what the Bible consistently teaches us to do. Keep our distance from temptation. Flee it, in fact, as he does in a few verses' time. I think most Christians who fall sexually begin unintentionally. That is, they don't wake up and think, "I'm going to commit sexual adultery or immorality today." But rather through relationships that just somehow develop along the wrong paths, they get involved and they fall, they lose control, their weakness overcomes them, and they end up going where they ought not to go. Joseph gives a wide berth to temptation. It is the Bible's teaching consistently. We are not strong enough to deal with it. We should keep clear of it. We are weak. the lascivious, that is, lustful Mrs. Potiphar, acts rather desperately. One day, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and while no one else was in the house, what did she do? She caught hold of his garment, saying, "Lie with me." The word is violent, that is, caught hold of. It's as though she jumped out from behind a doorway and grabbed hold of him around his neck, grabbing his shirt or cloak or jacket as though she was ripping it off him. That's the force of the word there. She's desperate, this woman. And Joseph flees. He does exactly what he should do in that situation. This is not a place to reason it out. It's a time to run. And he ran, as he should. And he left his garment behind in her hands, we're told in verse 12. Well, a woman scorned is a dangerous thing. And Mrs. Potiphar turns nasty and conniving. How often that's the case, where one act of sin, in this case lust and desire for sexual immorality, compounds and snowballs into others. Here, downright lies. But it's always the case. One sin leads to another sin leads to another, getting worse, getting bigger, compounding and snowballing, until somebody is just trapped in the slavery of sin, as she is here. Her lust leads to lies, sin leads to more sin. And so she says to the other slaves in verse 14, she cries out and says to them, "See, my husband has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice, and when he heard me raise my voice and cry out, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." Notice how there she's trying to appeal to her other slaves, in effect to back her up. So she passes some of the blame for Joseph onto her husband. He's not there. He's out at work in the office. It almost reminds us of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, all over again. One blaming the other or blaming God. "The woman you gave me made me eat," Adam said. But also she talks about how her husband has brought this Hebrew man among us. That is, here's the woman of the house drawing in us with her slaves. Maybe she had little to do with them usually, but here she is appealing to her slaves saying, "Us, we're the victims here," drawing them into her story so that they are on her side. Notice how she uses a little bit of racism. The Hebrew man was brought in. Anti-Semitism in its earliest form, perhaps. Notice, too, how she reverses the order of truth. That is, the truth that we've been told was that Joseph fled, then she cried out. But she said she cried out, then Joseph fled. She's got the truth, but she's inverted the order, so it's actually a downright lie. But by keeping elements of the truth there, her story is sounding a little bit more plausible, I suppose. And notice how she lies about the garment. "He left it there beside me," she said. Whereas the truth is, he left it in her hands because she ripped it off. If he left it beside her, it implies that he took it off. He didn't, she did. Well, the slave's response is not recorded. The next words are again the woman, as soon as hubby gets home, in verses 17 and 18. When he got in, she told him the same story, but it's slightly different. Because now she's appealing to her husband to back her up, not the slaves. So there are a few little differences in the way she tells the story to try and get his support. Notice how she says the Hebrew servant. Before it was the Hebrew man, because she's talking to slaves, so she doesn't want to denigrate them by saying a Hebrew slave, it's just a Hebrew man. But now she can denigrate the slaves because she's appealing to her husband. "Whom you have brought among us," so she's toning down her blame of her husband, "came in to me to insult me. But as soon as I raised my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and he fled outside." Again, the reversion of truth, and again, the garment being left in the wrong spot. She's a devious woman. She's telling the story to appeal to two different groups to get them to back her up. And the husband believes her and he's enraged and he puts Joseph in prison. Why Joseph isn't executed for adultery, we're not quite sure. He probably should have been. It might mean that the husband actually doubts his wife's story, but nonetheless, Joseph ends up in prison. Some people have no dress sense. And for the second time in his life, his clothes have got him stuck. Joseph's technicolour dream coat led to the jealousy of his brothers, and they used the coat as evidence of a lie that he'd been killed by a wild animal. We saw that last week. And now the second time, another garment taken off him by a raving, lustful woman, and again used as evidence of a lie that he tried to rape her. Joseph, it seems, comes unstuck with clothes. Clothes maketh some men, but obviously not Joseph. But what's more disturbing this time than last week's story, when he's in effect betrayed by his brothers, is that this time he is unimpeachable in his character. You see, last week we saw how his brothers betrayed him. There was a sense of understanding about that. That is, he seems to be a bit arrogant and a bit boastful to his brothers because he's had some dreams that he is the chief of them and they're all bowing down to him. And he's the favourite of his father and he's wearing this rather glamorous coat. So you've almost got a bit of sympathy with the brothers. But not here. He's above reproach. Every word and every action has been absolutely right here. So where's God in all this? How does he end up in prison? We're told at the beginning of this chapter that God was with him. It led to his success. It led to his promotion. It led to the blessing on Potiphar's household. But where's God now? Isn't God in the business of rewarding the righteous? Isn't God in the business of honouring those who honour him? Isn't God in the business of justice? Well, how can Joseph end up in prison so unjustly? Isn't God supposed to stop this sort of thing happening? What kind of a God is it who will let somebody of such fantastic character as Joseph end up wallowing in an Egyptian jail? Well, God has not abandoned Joseph, of course, because the last three verses of the chapter keep emphasizing the fact that God was with him in jail. But it's as though the story is starting all over again. Instead of being in Potiphar's house where God is with him and giving him blessing and promotion and responsibility, now he's in jail and there's blessing and there's promotion and there's responsibility in jail. And we're going into the same cycle all over again, it seems. What's God doing with Joseph? It doesn't quite seem fair. For the rest of the story of Joseph, the next 11 chapters, the name of the Lord, Yahweh, that's the name that's used in those opening verses and closing verses of this chapter, is not used again, apart from Jacob's blessing in chapter 49. The name God is mentioned a few times, but never the name of the Lord. But nonetheless, we're meant to see that at every point of the story, both in the initial part of the Potiphar's house and in jail and in between when he's betrayed by this woman, as well as everything else that follows in the next 11 chapters, the Lord was with him. At every point, never abandoned, always with him. The point is that obedience to God does not bring immediate reward. Joseph's maltreatment is evidence of that. Obedience does not preclude somebody from trouble and strife and testing and trial. Joseph's maltreatment is evidence of that. But too many Christians get bitter with God when things go wrong. They think, I've been acting honourably to God. I've been obedient. I've been attending church. I've been reading my Bible. I've been praying. I've been doing what I ought to be doing. And now somehow God is punishing me. I've lost my job, or my health has failed, or somebody's died, or some catastrophe has awaited me. And too many Christians get bitter with God, thinking somehow God owes them one, and he's delivered them ill fortune instead. And their heart gets hardened, and their faith gets weakened, and in the end they turn away from God. Not so Joseph. He understood that that was a wrong equation. that obedience does not necessarily bring immediate reward, that obedience does not necessarily preclude trouble and strife and unfairness and injustice, that God being with him didn't mean life would be easy and rich blessings would flow from every act of obedience. But rather, Joseph illustrates and demonstrates the ideal follower of the Lord Yahweh. He fears God. He resists temptation. He refuses to commit adultery. He's honest. He's loyal. He's the archetypal wise man of the book of Proverbs. But the wise man of the Bible and the wise man of the book of Proverbs is not immune from trouble and injustice and unfairness and poverty and oppression or persecution. The lot of the unjust, or the lot of injustice rather, and inexplicable suffering is often that of the righteous person. Joseph illustrates that. Job illustrates that. Moses, perhaps, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, many people in the Old Testament. But the climax of that biblical pattern, that the righteous person may well face injustice in this life, trouble, strife, and persecution, the climax of that pattern is the cross of Christ, the perfect man, dying unfairly, unjustly, put to death for crimes he did not commit. The one whose own character was absolutely and perfectly and totally above reproach in every manner, and yet crucified. What kind of a God would let Joseph wallow in prison? The same kind of God who lets his own son die on a cross unfairly and unjustly. Not a God who doesn't care, but a God who wrings good out of evil. A God who in the big picture and his big purposes for his people is a purpose of good, not evil. And even in the face of evil and out of evil, God will bring ultimate good for his people. Maybe not immediately. Maybe not as a consequence of one act of obedience leading to one act of blessing and reward and so on. But in the big scale of things, when we get to chapter 50, to the end of this story and the end of Joseph's life, he can look back on his life full of trouble and strife and say, God has meant this for good, not evil. And so too with us. Don't be too narrow-minded in the way that you become bitter with God when things go wrong. But see the big picture, the big purposes of God. See the ultimate destiny that he promises those who are righteous in his sight. Amen.